Good morning. All right, our next matter on our docket this morning is number 69238, State Department of Transportation versus District Court. Mr. Sylvester, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, and good morning.
Good morning. Would you like to reserve some time?
5 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Jeffrey Sylvester, prepared on behalf of the State of Nevada on relation to its Department of Transportation. May it please the Court, by this petition, the State of Nevada is requesting that this Court enter an order setting aside or vacating the District Court's order refusing to enforce the terms and conditions of the settlement, and further requesting that this Court enter an order compelling the District Court to enforce the terms of the settlement agreement entered into by and between the parties, on May 19th, 2015. It is clear that the District Court committed...
So to be clear, you're asking only the email exchange, none of the additional conditions. I mean, you're seeking writ relief directing that you pay $2,990,000 and Mr. McRae's client accept it.
That is correct, because those are the essential terms and conditions that the parties agreed upon by and through that email exchange of May 19th, 2015. At no point after that email exchange did the State of Nevada request, demand, or otherwise require the landowner to accept any additional changes or modifications to the settlement. While it is true that a form settlement agreement was propounded or proposed following the Board of Examiner approval, it was never conditioned upon or required to have been executed.
So what happens to the other terms? The terms of the settlement agreement?
There are no other terms. The only terms that we're asking this Court to enforce, and in fact that we asked the District Court to enforce, was the landowner's agreement to accept the sum of $2,990,000 as in for full and final just compensation and damages associated with the taking of that private property. And the point was, at the District Court level and today, was that at no point did we ever seek the District Court to enforce an agreement that the party hadn't already agreed to. We made that abundantly clear in both the motion practice as well as the argument, that at no time did we say that the state said you had to execute the settlement agreement in exchange for the payment of the sum of money. No question at all with respect to the fact that we weren't requesting that. In fact, the motion to enforce the same didn't attach thereto a copy of the settlement agreement, didn't ask the District Court to compel the landowner to accept any other term, whether it be a constitutional waiver or indemnification or any other waiver, before the state would pay the sum of $2,990,000. Because that was the terms of the agreement that were memorialized in the email exchange. No more.
What were some of the concerns with the settlement agreement other than the fact that if he didn't use the property, they had the opportunity to buy it back, and I understand you struck that, and several other aspects to the settlement agreement. And at one point, my understanding was you said, never mind the settlement agreement.
We did, because the Board of Examiners, when it, approved simply the payment of a cash settlement in exchange for a final order of condemnation. And to directly answer your question, we don't know, because there wasn't ever a give and take with respect to what provisions that the landowner found offensive. The factual record supports the chronology of events as follows. Once the Board of Examiners approved the agreement, we sent, that is the state sent over, a form of settlement agreement that it uses in its eminent domain actions. And in that form settlement agreement, it had things like the waiver of Article 1, Section 22, Subsection 6, specifically the landowner's right to repurchase the property if the property isn't used for its intended purpose. It also included things like indemnification. For instance, if we paid the wrong party, you agree to indemnify the state if somebody else makes a claim. Those are the standard provisions that NDOT uses to settle its eminent domain cases. Many of them were not relevant or applicable to this case. Like Justice Hardesty stated in the May decision, sometimes settlement agreements are nothing more than mechanical or legal means to effectuate a settlement. And in this case, specifically as it relates to the constitutional issue, it was never going to be an issue in this case, because that provision says if the state doesn't use the property that it has taken for a public purpose within 5 years of the date of the take, it shall revert back to the landowner in exchange for the landowner's agreement to repay the sum of money. But in this case, at that time, all of the public improvements had been completed. All of the utilities had been in place. All of the overhead utility lines had been established for a number of years. And so the idea that somehow the state was requesting a waiver of a constitutional right, it doesn't make sense in the context that that right never existed in this case because the improvements had been completed.
Let me ask you, though, let's say this court were to deny writ relief. What would happen? You would go to trial on how much money you need to pay Wyckoff, correct?
That's correct.
And what would that trial entail?
It is essentially competing experts. Because
appraisals, right?
That's correct. The district,
anything else?
That is it.
And let's say the trial came out and you were ordered to pay more money than $2,990,000. You were ordered to pay $4 million. And you wanted to appeal the settlement agreement, the failure to enforce it. Would that be appealable at that point as part of this?
It would be. It is an issue that would remain on appeal.
So why should we entertain this as a writ at this juncture? And as a matter of policy, is that a good idea given the statutory mandate that these cases be expedited to the extent possible, et cetera?
The answer is yes. While there is certainly a right to appeal the district court's denial of the motion to enforce the settlement agreement following a full trial on the merits, it is not an adequate and speedy remedy. And I say it's not adequate following this court's decision in D.R. Horton, when the court said determining whether or not an appellate or an issue is, or an appellate right is adequate, you have to look at the status of the proceedings, the issues raised on appeal, and whether or not on appeal there's going to be the opportunity to meaningfully review the issues that are contained in the writ. And the problem that we have with respect to that issue is that this is a constitutional proceeding. And while the district court order, essentially in March 2015, that the only issue remaining was just compensation, there was significant pretrial motion practice raising significant constitutional issues, not the least of which was whether or not the state had the right to take this property for the purpose of relocating utilities onto the landowner's property. This court entertained and denied a writ by the landowner early in that litigation, stating that you can address that issue on appeal. Because the landowner took the position that when NDOT used its eminent domain power to relocate utilities from the north side to the south side, it was essentially taking that private property for the private purpose for Nevada Power. And the court said that you can address that on appeal. The other issue that arises is that...
So you don't want to have to address that on appeal, and the settlement would conclude you having to write a brief on that subject that you've already run a writ on.
That's one. The second constitutional issue is whether or not there is a conclusive presumption that an eminent domain resolution presumes the public necessity. That's an issue that was raised and decided by the district court. And then also whether or not the landowner waives its right to challenge public necessity if it waits until after the improvements have been completed. Those three constitutionally important issues will accompany any appeal that occasions itself to this court. And the adequacy...
Doesn't that commend itself to an appellate process then?
It does, but the problem with that issue is that because those are so constitutionally important, the idea of a settlement agreement and whether the parties reach the essential terms will be marginalized by the impact, I think, of this court's inquiry into those seriously constitutional issues. And so we don't think that there is an adequate, meaningful review on appeal. The second point is even if there is an adequate and speedy remedy, this court may nevertheless exercise its discretion to intervene when there's an important issue of law that needs clarification. And the state submits that there needs to be some clarification to this court's prior holdings in Grisham and in May. And that, in those cases, Justice Pickering and Justice Hardesty both concluded that when the parties agree upon the essential terms, it is of no import, well, and they further agree to memorialize that in a further writing, the fact that they don't enter into an agreement doesn't affect the enforceability of the contract. Well, the district court did something different. What it said was, the essential terms have been agreed upon, but you didn't enter into and sign the settlement agreement, and therefore, there's no agreement. We've been giving some clarification to Grisham and May that says, if the parties, in fact, do contemplate a further writing or a memorial of the agreement, that they have the right to exchange settlement agreements without the settlement agreement manifesting a counteroffer or a repudiation of the original agreement.
Wasn't the crux of the district court's determination essentially the fact that there were material differences, and that's why it was became an issue? rather than the fact that there wasn't a settlement agreement?
And yes. One, that's a deviation from this court's holdings in Grisham and May, because the court said, even though the parties contemplated further writing, that's not going to affect the enforceability if the further writing isn't actually achieved. And two, the finding by the district court that the acceptance, essentially, by the Board of Examiners was conditional upon the execution of a settlement agreement is not supported by substantial evidence, and is, in fact, clearly erroneous. There is nothing that the Board Examiner required to be executed in exchange for the sum of money. And so when the district court indicated that there were additional terms, essentially it's either one or two things. It either is abandoning Grisham and May and requiring that there be a written settlement agreement, or two, it's a manifest misunderstanding of the approval process and the requirement that there be a settlement agreement executed in exchange. And one final point. The Board of Examiners approved the settlement without condition. There was no evidence, certainly no adequate evidence, to support the district court's finding that the form settlement agreement that was sent back following the unconditional approval was a counteroffer. So it's either clearly erroneous, not supported by substantial evidence, or it's a deviation from this court's holdings in Grisham and May.
I was just wondering if you're asking that we create an exception for state contracts, contracts with the government entity, when you're dealing with eminent domain as opposed to basic contract law. When I've seen settlement agreements, they've always been at the end. It's been signed, sealed, and delivered. I saw that in mass tort litigation in MGM and Hilton and Pepcon before any money was exchanged. Why should we do it differently for the State Department of Transportation?
You should. You should. But the district court did. The district court abandoned the holding of Grisham and May because, as Justice Pickering and Justice Hardy said, even if the parties agree upon the essential terms, and in this case, $2,900,000 as full and final just compensation, the fact that they also agreed to reduce it to a writing doesn't affect the enforceability of the contract. If NDOT didn't go forward and seek the approval, the landowner could have enforced the same contract because that was the only condition that had to be satisfied. It wasn't conditioned or subject to the execution of a settlement agreement. It was conditioned and subject to the approval of the Board of Examiners, which was achieved.
Will you give them the money if they don't sign any documents from here on out?
That's what we said. We said that in our motion to enforce. All we asked for, I mean, ultimately what the Board of Examiners requested and what was approved was the payment of money in exchange for a final order of condemnation. Now, to that point, petitioners, or the landowner's counsel, stood up in front of the district court and said, if they just simply gave us a final order of condemnation, we would have no defense to the enforceability. But essentially, they gave us a draft settlement agreement that had different terms.
So you withdrawing the draft settlement agreement?
We never asked the district court to enforce it. We never asked the district court to enforce the terms of a settlement agreement in form. All we said was, make the landowner accept the $2,900,000 because that's what they agreed to accept in exchange for a final order of condemnation. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McCray.
Good morning. May it please the court. Just a couple of points that I want to address from Mr. Sylvester's argument tonight. His contention that this proposed settlement agreement was nothing more than just a suggested form of agreement that we should execute in return for the $2.99 million that we had agreed on. When the Board of Examiners approved the settlement, the first notice I received of that was from an email from counsel saying the Board of Examiners approved the settlement, and attached hereto is the approved settlement agreement, suggesting to me that the Board of Examiners required this settlement agreement to be executed. We had some discussions, and this is in the record. We had some discussions among counsel at that time, and I noted a couple of errors in the legal descriptions that this proposed agreement contained. I also noted the waivers and representations and warranties that this agreement contained that we had never discussed. And I was told that, in particular, the waiver of my client's rights under the Pistol Amendment was non-negotiable. So I took that back to my client, and my client said this is unacceptable. And so I informed NDOT that these provisions were unacceptable, and that we deemed the settlement agreement repudiated and our offer withdrawn. Now, there are a couple of fundamental black letter principles of contract law here that NDOT just totally ignores. An offer does not become an enforceable contract until it is unconditionally accepted. We never had an unconditional acceptance of this offer. On May 19th, we had an email from Mr. Sylvester that said, we accept the offer subject to and conditioned upon Board of Examination approval. Okay. We said, okay, we'll give you time to get that approved. Well, that approval came on July 7th. Between July 7th and July 27th, we had these discussions about this proposed agreement. On July 27th, I notified NDOT in writing that this deal's off. We cannot accept these indemnities and waivers and releases that this agreement contains. On August 3rd, I filed my request for trial set. On August 4th, they filed their motion to enforce the settlement agreement. And that motion itself did not say, we're prepared to just settle this case without any kind of settlement agreement. That did not come until the reply was filed on September 1st. But that is really kind of irrelevant, because the second fundamental black letter principle of contract law that applies here is that once an offer is withdrawn, you no longer have a right to accept it unconditionally. That offer is off the table. And that's what happened when I sent my letter of July 27th. That's what happened when I filed the request for trial setting on August 3rd. And on August 5th, they sent back another proposed settlement agreement, this time removing the waiver of the Pistol Amendment, but all the other representations and warranties and indemnities were in the agreement. Assuming that they hadn't already repudiated the agreement, I didn't have a right to withdraw my offer, that didn't cure the problem. And I told them on August 6th in an email that we still consider these requested indemnities, waivers, and releases that are still contained in this proposed agreement unacceptable. And we have no further interest in discussing settlement. So on September 1st, when they finally came back and said in their reply in support of their motion to enforce that they no longer required an agreement of any kind, they'll just pay the money and take the judgment, it was too late. But let's go back to the beginning of these discussions. They were all prompted by an offer of judgment that I sent to NDOT a couple of weeks before the May 18th, May 19th exchange. That offer of judgment was sent on April 14th. And in it, we stated simply, we offer to allow judgment to be entered against us in this condemnation action for $3 million, period, simple. So when we had the discussion, the email exchange on the 18th and 19th, and the discussions that followed, it was understood that they were in that context. All we were saying was, we'll take ultimately $2.99 million instead of the $3 million that was in my offer of judgment. In return, you get the judgment you're asking for in the amended complaint, nothing more, that's it. But that's not what they came back with. And under the principles of contract law that I just iterated, the district court came to a proper result in this case.
On that point, Mr. McCray, could you answer a question for me? It's difficult, if not impossible, to determine from the district court's order
the basis for its rejection of the settlement agreement. It either concluded, as you're arguing, that there were subsequent negotiations and a repudiation of the prior agreement based upon the tender of the settlement agreement with additional terms and conditions. Or the district court concluded that that tender of the settlement agreement with conditions created new material terms, which would be in contrast with the May and Grisham decision. But it never made any finding about what material terms were missing. So which is it?
Well, I think the district court did come to the conclusion that the material, that the proposed agreements did constitute new material conditions. I think that's in the transcript. But I think also the district court...
It's not in its order, you would agree with that.
Well, no, it's not in the order. But it is in the record. Also, I think the court focused on District Court Rule 16 and 8 Judicial District Court Rule 7.5, which requires agreements and stipulations to either be entered into the court minutes in the form of an order, or to be in writing and subscribed by the parties against whom they're going to be enforced. And neither of those were...
Why couldn't the district court go back and assess the exchange of emails and conclude that those writings were sufficient to have created a contract in which the property was condemned to 2.990?
The only email the court could have gone back to and even arguably made that assessment would have been my email of May 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And that was made, as I said, made in the context of an offer of judgment that had been submitted earlier and never contemplated any of the other provisions that the Department of Transportation proposed and told us were non-negotiable. That later became unnecessary after we filed their motion to enforce the settlement. And after we had withdrawn our offer, which we had every right to do. But I think Justice Pickering, in her questions to Petitioner's Counsel, hit the issue on the head here, and that is that this is a writ proceeding, and the first question that this court must address is whether or not the petitioner here has met its burden to demonstrate that this court's extraordinary intervention is warranted at this time. And there is no need for that intervention at this time. They have a plain and adequate remedy in the form of a direct appeal once this case is ultimately tried. They have a plain and adequate remedy, and it's called a claim for breach of contract if they think they have an enforceable agreement.
And in fact, that's how May arose. May was a separate case,
exactly.
Not in the context of enforcing it in this action being settled. Is that right?
Exactly. That started out as a negotiation, auto accident, I believe, and the parties, without any court action pending, came to what they thought was
a... So May was a straight breach of contract case?
Yes. Yes, straight breach of contract. Grisham, on the other hand, that the plaintiffs rely upon, was a pending court case. It was a domestic relations case. And the parties had reached a property settlement agreement or a proposed property settlement agreement that had been all, you know, litigated and things like that. But it was read into the record at the time that the parties agreed to it. And so the court had, in the Grisham case, a record of exactly what the parties had agreed to. And when the settlement agreement was cleaned up and put into final form, the husband refused to sign. Well, District Court Rule 16 and 8 Judicial District Court 7.5 obviously applied in that case, and the court had no problem in concluding it.
Well, why wouldn't you say that the email exchange was the writing and that when there was a letter sent to the district court to remove the trial calendar date, pending submission to the Board of Examiners. If you assume they didn't come back with this complicated settlement agreement, at that point, could it have been enforced under Grisham?
I don't know.
You follow the question?
I think I follow the question. I don't know if it would have been enforceable under Grisham. But under ordinary principles of contract law, they could have unconditionally accepted the offer anytime after the Board of Examiners approved the amount, which was July 7th. They didn't finally unconditionally accept that until September 1st when they filed their reply.
By which time you'd withdrawn your offer?
We'd withdrawn the offer by then. Unless the court has any further questions,
Mr. Mullings?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCray.
Just stating to address your question with respect to May, my reading of May was that was a pre-litigation settlement that the parties had entered into, and despite the fact that the parties had entered into a settlement agreement, the plaintiff nevertheless commenced an action on the underlying tort claim. And that issue was resolved in the context of a motion to dismiss based upon the prior settlement. So it wasn't an action on the contract to enforce the settlement. Counsel Landowner conceded that all the material terms of the agreement had been satisfied by virtue of the email exchange. That is the amount of just compensation in exchange for the final order of condemnation. He concedes that the only condition to the acceptance, as it must have been, was the approval by the Board of Examiners. The Board of Examiners never considered the draft settlement agreement. It wasn't part of the public agenda. It wasn't submitted for its review and approval. That is, the Board of Examiners, the Governor, the Attorney General, and Secretary of State never saw, passed upon, or inquired of the foreign settlement agreement. That's clear from the record, as much as that's what's on the agenda, and that's what's in the recommendation from NDOT to the BOE. That recommendation is a matter of public record, which was provided to counsel for the landowner in advance of the Board of Examiners hearing, because counsel had inquired along the continuum what the status of approval was.
So what was McCray supposed to tell his client when he sees the client sees indemnities, releases, and waivers, and says, wait a minute, Charles, I didn't agree to this. I agreed to 2.9, but I didn't agree to indemnification, releases, and waivers.
Well, great. Don't sign a proposed settlement agreement. But what happens in this case is remarkable, because immediately upon receiving the form settlement agreement, counsel for the landowner contacts NDOT and says, make changes. Twice. Both times, without question, without delay, the changes to that settlement agreement were made. And then counsel was radio silent for 2 weeks. We don't hear another response until the 24th, prompted by, again, inquiry from counsel for the state, saying, what's the status of the settlement agreement? And the only response we get was, it's a rejection. So it's not as though the parties were at loggerheads or there was an impasse negotiating the settlement agreement. They had continued on that path. And if I may finish my thought. They had continued on that path. And the evidence then suggests that it wasn't conditional, because nobody made it conditional. And that wasn't any part of the acceptance of the BOE. When they sent the letter back on the 27th, it said, we consider the waiver of 4C to be a repudiation. Now, that's a red herring, because as we discussed a moment ago, that relates to an issue that is not germane to this litigation. Nothing is more manifest of the fact that it was a forum settlement agreement was the inclusion of that constitutional waiver that had no application in this case because the improvements had been completed. And so the district court either disregarded May and Grisham by requiring a formal settlement agreement, despite the fact that the essential terms have been agreed upon, or its finding that the BOE's approval was conditional is a manifest abuse of discretion because it's not supported by substantial evidence or is otherwise clearly erroneous. And unless you have any further questions.
Colleagues, I have one. You indicated that in the motion to enforce, you only sought an enforcement of the essentially exchange of emails. But counsel makes the point that you only did that in the reply, not in the original motion. Didn't you, in the original motion, seek enforcement of the latest version of the settlement agreement?
We did not. Because, and again, all we were trying to do, and as an aside, the moment I received counsel's correspondence saying it was repudiation, within 2 hours of that email correspondence, I responded by saying, no, we don't intend to change or materially alter the settlement agreement. I'm certain that we can work through any issues. And so that tells you that in a sense it wasn't a precondition. And we went to the district court. We didn't even know He hadn't raised the issues of indemnification and waivers. We didn't have that email exchange or that impasse. It was in the reply where we see for the first time, other than what he articulated in the correspondence, all of the bases which we believe were manufactured to avoid accepting the sum of money that they requested as in for settlement.
Okay, thank you. Anything else?
All right. Thank you, counsel, for the briefs and your arguments today. This matter will stand.